You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the FEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the FEA.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are thrilled to be in Portland, Oregon, joined by a key member of the Sonics 1996 NBA Finals team, and now the director of player programs director for the Portland Trail Blazers, Hersey Hawkins. Thanks for joining us.
Kevin, thank you. Appreciate it.
We wanted to kind of walk you through your time with the Sonics and talk about kind of some of the key moments, high points, and get your perspective on it. So that starts with, you know, being traded to the Sonics on draft night 95 in a trade for Kendall Gill along with David Wingate. Were you expecting that? Did you see that coming at all?
I actually did not see that coming. That was one of those trades that took me by surprise. You know, pleasant surprise, but, you know, I had only been in Charlotte for two seasons, and, you know, I thought things were going well. But, you know, whenever the team tracks you down on a golf course, you figure something's wrong. That is not good news. And that's what happened. You know, I was sort of golfing and got a call that the GM needed to talk to me. And it's like, okay, well, that's not good news. But, you know, to go to Seattle was a pleasant surprise. You know, just from being in the league, you knew how good they were and the makeup of their team. And hopefully it was just I could be a good addition.
Did you have a sense of what it would be like coming to Seattle? I think in Philadelphia, you're kind of the second scoring option, Charlotte, maybe a little bit more than that. And then coming to Seattle, they had Sean Kemp and Gary Payton involved. Did you have a sense of what that would mean for you, especially offensively?
Well, I think the crazy thing about it is I never really thought about, you know, offensively how I would fit in. I think at that time, the first thing came to my mind was Seattle was such a defensive team. George Karl, I think, was more of a defensive coach. So the only thing I was thinking was, how am I going to fit in defensively? You know, of course, Gary had the reputation as being the glove, and, you know, Nate was good defensively. So it was one of those, okay, defensively, will I be able to fit in? Offensively, I knew I can add something to them. Because Kendall Gill really wasn't a three-point shooter, so I knew that with the post-ups of Sean and Gary that I would be able to stretch the defense out a little more and give them more room to operate. So offensively, I knew I would get shots, but I knew I would probably be then maybe the third or the fourth option, you know, with Sean, Gary, then Detlef, then maybe myself. But so it worked out pretty well.
How about from a leadership standpoint? Because that was such an important part of that trade from the Sonics standpoint, coming off a couple years where they had lost in the first round of the playoffs. Obviously, it's had some turmoil at times in the locker room. How important was that made out to be of your role?
It really wasn't wasn't anything that was brought up that often. We had a veteran team, you know, guys like Detlef and Sam, Nate. So I think it was more of just coming and fitting in and playing my role, I think, and not trying to do anything more than, you know, what was asked of me. And, you know, and that's what I tried to do. You know, we had smart players. We had guys which at that time were sort of in their last year or the last 1 or 2 years of the contract. So when you have veteran guys and you have that, the contract status, I think everyone just, you do whatever it takes to win. You sacrifice because you know that you're sort of getting to that point in your career where, you know, a championship is getting further and further away. So you need to do whatever you can to win. And that's what we did.
Okay, so you go through that season, your first season in Seattle, the Sonics are great, have, I think, two home losses throughout the year. Finished the season as the number one seed in the West, and then play the Kings in the first round of the playoffs. First round had been tough for the Sonics the previous couple of seasons, including a year where they were the number one seed in the 92-93 season, 93-94 season, losing against Denver, and then go down, I believe, 2-1 against the Kings in that series.
It was 1-1, and then down in the fourth quarter, I think, of game three of that series. I mean, how much was there a sense that started to creep in of here we go again, even though you weren't part of that team?
Well, even though I wasn't part of it, you could still, you know, you could still feel the tension and everything. But it was so ironic that, and I think George Karl terrific coach. But after we were 1-1 heading back to Sacramento, you know, when everybody thought, of course, we should have been up 2-0, you know, but losing one game to an eighth seed. I remember after the game, George Karl just, you know, he wasn't upset. You know, he didn't say much. He just came in the locker room and said, you know, like, guys, hey, we're going to go down to Sacramento. We're going to win two. We're going to end this thing, and we're going to get to the second round. I was like, okay. All right. I think I believe just the confidence that he said in it. It was like, all right, we, you know, we're not in trouble.
So was there a bit of a monkey off your back at that point? Because then you close out the series with the Kings and then sweep the two-time defending champion Rockets in the next round.
Yeah, it was. Now, that was the, I think, the, you know, the sweep series, you know, the going to beat Houston 4-0, that was huge for us. Just, you know, from the aspect of getting a little rest. And, you know, now, like you said, maybe having that monkey off your back, it relieved a lot of tension. And, you know, and we were just, you know, on a high. We were playing good ball. We knew it. And at that time, yeah, we knew we were the second best team in the league behind Chicago and thought we could beat them. So it was just a matter of, you know, putting the pieces together, continuing to play hard, sticking to the game plans, and then just getting out of the West.
How about the fans' support during that playoff run? I mean, I remember rallies and, you know, the Supersonics chant really caught on. Had you experienced anything like that previously in your career?
No, not even close. I've actually, that run, you know, during the season and during the playoffs, I think that building may have been as loud as I had ever heard it. And sometimes you got chills that it was so loud. You know, but Seattle fans have always, you know, my 4 years there, they were terrific, you know, came out and supported the team, you know. And I always thought they knew as long as you played hard, you went out there and put, you know, forth a good effort, then, you know, they would support you. And you know, so it was a great time.
Okay, so you wrap up that season or the series with the Rockets and then go into the series with the Utah Jazz, the Western Conference Finals, and end up playing a game 7 at home against Utah. What is running through your head and what is kind of the pulse of the team going into that game 7 against Utah?
At that time, I think the pulse of the team that we were going to win it. You know, I think you play all season long to get that home court advantage, to have that one game in your building. Even though we were coming off a throttling in game 6, I think they beat us maybe by 40 or something like that in game 6. But, you know, we were confident. You know, it was a veteran team. We had tough losses, you know, during the season or games that we thought we should have won and we lost. So it was just a matter of regrouping and, you know, just sticking to the game plan. Utah, they weren't going to change anything. We weren't going to change anything. It was just going to be who wanted it the most, who was going to execute, who was going to, you know, make the small plays to win the game. And in the end, we ended up making all plays to advance.
So you mentioned thinking you guys were the second, you know, could beat the Bulls, were the second best team in the league. Was there an intimidation factor with them winning 72 games, setting the record that year? Or, you know, you guys won 64 in your own right? I mean, you know, a confidence from that you can play with anyone and then splitting the season series with them too.
Yeah, we were pretty confident. You know, honestly, I thought that we had better talent from 1 to 12. I thought we were more talented of a team. I thought our bench was better. And I think what happened to us, in my opinion, is when we got to the finals, it's such a huge stage that for a team to go there for the first time, have a lot of players to experience it for the first time, it's sometimes overwhelming. The media coverage and the interview request and every other thing that you have to do. And I thought the Bulls, I thought, handled it better than we did because they had been there before. And the next thing you know, we were down, you know, 3-0, and it's like, what happened? You know, and I think it was because they were more prepared just from the jump. And it took us a little time to sort of get our feet wet and to really get involved and get ourselves and realize that, hey, this is the finals and you got to step up. So at least we made a decent series out of it.
Is there anything that you look back on from that series that maybe not you would have done differently, but that you wish the team would have done differently? We always point to putting Gary on Jordan kind of further on in the series.
You know what? I don't know. I thought George did a pretty good job of trying to mix up the coverages on Jordan, you know, not trying to, you know, get him used to that same look every time. And, you know, with him, you sort of had to do that. And it's funny, I think the only thing I really remember about, I guess, that series and something that I sort of regrettable to me is, I think it was game 6 in Chicago. I think we were down 2 and I missed a wide open 3 on the left wing. And for some reason, that shot, I think about that shot occasionally today and think like, man, if I would have made that shot and put us up 1, you know, it was the fourth quarter. You know, I made maybe 5-6 minutes left, you know, and I think, like, if I would have made that shot, who knows what happens, you know, at that time to put us up 1. But I missed it, and they came down and scored, and, you know, then it went from, like, 2 to, I think, maybe 4 or 5, and I'm like, oh, gosh. So, yeah, that's the one thing I regret and I think about the most during the entire finals.
I mean, obviously not what you want as a competitor, but, you know, given that Chicago team is generally regarded as the greatest of all time, to have beat them a couple times, blown them out, and then also played that series in your hometown, I mean, what does that kind of mean to you looking back?
You know, it means a lot. Of course, to play against, you know, one of the, you know, as you said, greatest teams of all time, and to hold your own, you know, I don't know how crazy I was to be going back to Chicago. Could you imagine a ticket request? You know, a hometown guy playing in the finals against the Bulls. It was funny because everybody had to go under aliases when we checked into the hotels. And so it was good. A lot of people couldn't get a hold of me, but, you know, it was still, they were still at the hotel. They would find a way in. And so that was that was awful. You know, because you want to help people out. You want them to see the game, but it's like, come on, I can't get 30 or 40 tickets to the finals. No, it's not happening. But, you know, other than that, you know, yeah, it was very memorable. You know, to play against the finals, definitely in the highlight of my career to play against the Bulls in the finals.
I thought it was interesting. Tristan talked earlier about kind of the different role that you played. One of the interesting things I found is, you know, a couple times that Detlef missed time during the 95-96 season, the 96-97, the following year, you know, in 95-96, he missed 19 games and you averaged 18.6 points per game. Sonics went 14-5 in that span. Next year, you averaged 20.3 points per game, and that's the 17 games that he missed due to injury. Was that kind of, you know, was there a sense of more responsibility or, you know, kind of an opportunity to do more when he was out of the lineup?
Well, I think it was just more of an opportunity to, of course, whenever, you know, you have a score or you have someone that goes down that was, you know, as instrumental to our offense as Detlef was, you know, Detlef, I think, has always been one of the most underrated players in the league at all the things that he can do on the offensive end of the floor, as well as, you know, compete defensively. So whenever someone went down, I just looked at it as an opportunity. Someone has to take a load of that load to get more shots up, to be more aggressive offensively. And that's what I did. And, you know, typically during those times, George would then draw up a few more plays to get me a little more involved in the offense. So we weren't putting all the pressure on Gary and Sean to make up those points. You know, we had to spread it out a little so they made me a little more active part in the offense.
So the next season, you come back after going to the finals the previous year in round 2 against the Rockets. I remember, I think it was, what was the game? Game 4 against the Rockets. You hit a 3 to send the game to overtime. Huge, I think it was a corner 3 to send the game to overtime. Huge play. And then the Rockets end up winning that game, force game 7, but then lose the series to the Rockets. Kind of what is going through your head and through the team's head at that point? It felt like that was kind of one of the last games of that era for the Sonics, and kind of what are you thinking going into those playoffs?
Well, of course, you know, coming off the previous season of playing the Rockets, you know, we're feeling pretty good about our chances of beating them. I think they did add Charles Barkley, so he was, you know, which is a huge addition to a team that, you know, had already gone to the second round, and to bring him on, you know, and even, you know, made him even better. But I remember from that series is no team could really win on their home court. I think Houston ended up winning game 7 in Houston on their floor, but you know, I can remember that shot vividly because I think we were down sort of late in the fourth quarter. Of course, we needed the three to tie it up, but I think we were even down further than that, maybe 8 or 9, and sort of made a comeback at the end. And, you know, I tried to get one off before. It was a defender around me, so I sort of pump faked it and threw it to Gary, and he threw it right back to me, which surprised me. And, you know, then, you know, of course, you know, the rest was history. I was able to make the shot. But that was one of those moments where it's like the roof is getting ready to come off this building. It was so loud, like you couldn't hear anything, because me and Gary started hugging each other, but I couldn't hear what he was saying because it was so loud in the building. And, you know, that's the Seattle fans.
So one thing I had in my notes from that series that I couldn't really find anything to corroborate is that after you guys went down 3-1, that Bill Russell had told you specifically and maybe Coach Carl to take it one game at a time. Is that something you remember?
I think that may be some of the fairy tale going out of it, because I don't remember seeing Bill Russell during that time, unless I'm totally have brain lock here. but no, someone's spreading rumors.
So I figured I'd check just in case. So something else interesting that happened that season was that Sir Mix-a-Lot came out with a song for the Sonics, as he had done in 92-93, but this one, Who's the Kings of the West Side, and specifically the section about feeding the hawk with the hawk noise. How often did you hear that repeated to you after that song came out?
That song was a curse. No, actually, it's one of the things where, you know, it's because I think the following season, or it may have been during that season, but maybe the following season, they actually started selling T-shirts in a team shop that said "Feed the Hawk." So, and I had heard the song, but, you know, sort of never really paid that close attention to it, and was like, where are they getting that from, man? And somebody finally told me, you know, listen to the song again. So I, you know, listened to it. So I'm like, hey, so I have to give Sir Mix-a-Lot a lot of credit for that. You know, it's a curse and a blessing all wrapped in one.
And then Sean is traded that summer to Cleveland. You pick up Vin Baker. What was going through your mind when the Sonics pulled off this blockbuster trade?
Disappointed to see Sean leave. You know, sure, of course, Sean and Gary are the cornerstone of that team. And honestly, I've said several times, I think besides Michael Jordan, I think Sean Kemp may have been the second best player in the league for a couple of years. He was playing that outstanding on both ends of the floor and was that big of a difference maker. So, you know, when you have a guy on your team like that, and you know that you can just get the ball to him, he can make plays for other people and he can score himself, to see him leave is disappointing. You know, not to take anything away from Vin Baker, who coming to us was an outstanding player. I think maybe a 2-3-time All-Star at that point. So we knew we were getting someone solid, but, you know, a guy like Sean Kemp is hard to replace. But we knew if we just, you know, fit Vin in there, he would be off, you know, he would be able to give us the scoring that we needed. And it was just a matter of, you know, the defensive aspect of it. You know, would he be able to match what Sean did on the floor?
All right, so the first round the following season, probably another memorable moment for you, for Sonics fans. Again, the Sonics fall down 2-1 in the first round to a lower-seeded team, Minnesota. And as I recall, it was at that point that kind of the defensive assignment switched. So you moved on Stephon Marbury, who got shut down the next two games. He had he shot a combined 6 of 26 the next two games and had 17 points and 10 turnovers in those two. You score 24 in both Game 4 and Game 5 after scoring 20 points just three times during the regular season. What kind of switched in that series as the Sonics were able to come back?
I don't know. I guess I think, of course, the switch with me guarding him was huge. But I also think they may have, because I switched to guard him, I think they left him then on me. And, you know, I've always said it's hard for a point guard to guard a two guard when you're not used to running off screens and chasing guys off screens all the time. it wears on you. And I think with Mulberry, I think that's what happened. So it was able to free me up a lot more for open shots. And of course, I think George saw that with him guarding me, that I would have more opportunities. So I was able to score a little more. And defensively, I've just always been one that I've always looked at the scouting report. I try not to gamble much. So I think they knew that I would just try to stay in front of them and make them take difficult shots. Where Gary, Gary can guard you and can lock you up, but he still liked to roam a little. He would roam and get steals and, try to play the passing lanes, where I was a little more conventional that if they put me on somebody, I'm like, okay, I got him. And so it sort of worked out that way. It worked out well for us.
Yeah, I think your defense was a little bit underrated during the era, but huge to those teams. And then the next round, Sonics lose 4-1 to the Lakers. Did that kind of feel like the end of that 90s era Sonics to you, or how were you feeling coming out of that series?
It was depressing. you don't mind losing in a series, maybe if it's 4-2 or 4-3, then you can. But to get beat 4-1, it's hard to swallow, and it was hard for me to swallow against that. The Lakers, they were good at the times. Shaq, I think, pretty much dominated that series. We had to double team him every time he touched the ball, and they did a good job of knocking down the threes. But I don't know if I would say that it was the end, but I think it was one of those times where you knew something had to change, that we were no longer the powerhouse. When you get 4-1, that some changes have to be made, and you got to revamp the lineup a little to get yourself back up there where you're competing now against, which was the Lakers and Utah and Houston at the time.
Yeah, so the most noteworthy change, of course, that was George Karl's last year as head coach, replaced by Paul Westphal. And after the lockout, brought in a couple players of free agents, including Billy Owens, who ended up starting at the beginning of that season ahead of you, ending the longest consecutive game started streak in the NBA at 461 games. Said all the right things at the time, but was that difficult?
Okay.
There's the answer.
I like how you threw that in there. I actually meant it at the time. It was one of the things, I've always been a team player, and I've always been like, hey, what's ever best for the team. And, Paul and I actually talked about it before he decided to make the move. And I'm like, if you think it's better for the team, then go ahead. But what got me upset was the fact that, then whatever it was, 10, 15 games later, he was like, you're back in the starting lineup. So I'm like, well, what the hell did you do? Why did you break the streak? Then I was mad. So I'm like, oh, come on, man. You might as well keep him in the starting lineup. But because, a streak like that doesn't, come along often, and I would have liked to have kept it going. But, it's just one of them things where you have to swallow your pride and say, okay, it's still best for the team. And, I've always been, listen to the coach, the direction of the coach. And he had something that he wanted to do, so I was cool with it.
I mean, what was then that season as a whole like? You guys start out 6-0, and it feels like, okay, maybe this can be, even with the coaching change, a continuation of that success under George Karl. But then, lose 9 of the next 12 and end up at 500 out of the playoffs. How was that kind of to experience as a veteran player?
It was tough. And I think then I knew that, okay, something's going to happen this summer with somebody, that things had to change. And if I'm correct, I think that was the lockout season as well, where, under normal circumstances, who knows, what kind of season you have. But when you're playing 3 in a row, then, take a day off, then you have another 3 in a row. I think they just had to squish as many games in that short period of time. But, I think it was it's one of them seasons where things got off track, communication wise, and things on the floor, and we just was never able to get it back. And it's unusual because we still had talent on that team, but for some reason it just did not come together. Guys didn't respond well, I think, that year to Paul, and that pretty much led to the 500 season.
Did you have a sense that something was off with Vin that year going into the season and then kind of how he was playing throughout the year? I know he had the a bit of the yips shooting free throws especially.
The free throw thing, of course, was unusual, and we couldn't pinpoint or figure out, you know, why such a good shooter all of a sudden, you know, had the yips at the free throw line. But, you know, there were other signs that things weren't right with Vin. I think that was the time when guys started noticing, you know, the drinking and, you know, the extra partying that he was doing. And, you know, you try to, as a friend and as a teammate, you know, you try to talk to players when you see them, you know, sort of heading down that direction and steer them back or bring them back to the fold. But, you know, sometimes, you know, they have to learn the hard way. You know, with Vin, it was just one of those cases. You know, great guy, you know, love him to death. You know, we still talk today, but, you know, he learned a lot from it. And, you know, the great thing about it is now he uses that as a teaching point to go around and, you know, talk to teams or other players to guard against those kind of circumstances.
So maybe a personal highlight of that 98-99 season, winning the NBA Sportsmanship Award. What did that mean to you?
It meant a lot. You know, I've always prided myself on trying, you know, to do the right things and trying to say the right things out on the court and, you know, not letting my emotions get the best of me. And so, you know, it meant, especially when I, you know, I had three boys who, you know, of course, as sons, they're going to look up to their dad and, you know, they wanted to play basketball. So, you know, if I can try to teach them how to act, you know, respond the right way out on the court, then, you know, I couldn't ask for, you know, anything better than that. And, you know, I can remember one game when I was with the Sonics, we got blown out. I don't know who it was by, but I can remember my son in the back seat saying to me, like, he said, "Dad," he said, I'm proud of you. And I'm like, "Why are you proud of me?" And he's like, "Well," he said, "everybody tonight was cursing at the officials and they were, you know, and they were have a lot of technicals or whatever." And he's like, "And you just played." And I'm like, "Well, thanks, son." You know, I appreciate that. But, you know, it's moments like that that make you realize that you're doing the right thing and that you're playing the game the right way.
All right. So after that season, traded by the Sonics to Chicago in a deal that brought Brent Barry to Seattle. Going to a rebuilding team probably couldn't have been particularly exciting to you. Was it salvaged at all by going to, you know, your hometown?
Yeah, I think that was the only, I guess, good thing about it. You know, I guess years before playing them in the finals was a curse. But, you know, to having an opportunity, you know, to play for your home team, you know, for an entire season, you know, where you grew up was, you know, it was special. You know, unfortunately, that was the only season I ever had an injury. So I missed some games that year. But and plus, it was a sort of tail end of my career. I think it was maybe year 12 for me. So, you know that your career is sort of dwindling down. People are GMs and coaches, they're looking at you a little differently than, you know, the guy that's going to put a lot of points in. They're looking at you as more of a mentor. So I didn't mind the role. You know, it was a good rookie class that we had coming in with the Bulls. We knew we weren't going to be good, but it was just a matter of growing and getting better and just teaching the young guys, you know, how to play the game.
So now I'm curious, kind of looking back at your time with the Sonics, especially being with the Sonics during some of the best seasons they've ever had as a franchise and the finals appearance and that impressive run. Is there anything in your role now with the Blazers that you've taken from that time period that kind of informed your work that you're doing in the front office with the team now?
I think the only thing, I guess, being an ex-player, you know, in my role with the Blazers is, you know, player programs, you know, I get a lot of opportunities to talk to the players about, you know, not only life, but, you know, basketball and my opinion, you know, what I think of it. And you know, I try not to too often dwell about, yeah, what I played, you know, because no one wants to hear that. But I do get the opportunity to tell them about, you know, hey, how, you know, despite the NBA hasn't changed much as far as, you know, what it takes to win games, you know, what it takes to be a good teammate. You know, and so those things I can share with them, you know, as well as little tidbits. But, you know, I'm not much on the coaching side. So, you know, I don't I try not to step on any of our coaches' toes or do anything that I shouldn't be doing. So a lot of it is, you know, personal. And, you know, when the court stuff comes up, then I give them my opinion.
I mean, as you look back, how important were those 4 years in Seattle to your career and the success that you guys enjoyed there?
Oh, extremely important. I think winning, of course, you know, is you're happy wherever you're winning. But to be with a good organization, you know, to play with good people, to play in a city that was as supportive as Seattle, you know, with great fan base. You know, I cherish those moments. You know, it's crazy that my wife and I, you know, being here in Portland, that now, I don't know, what are we, 20 years later, that, you know, we still consider Seattle as one of our favorite places we've ever lived. And, you know, we've always talked about the possibility of going back because, you know, we have tons of friends there, probably more than any place we've been. We have more friends in Seattle. So it will always have a special place in our heart. And you never know. Hopefully when a team comes back there 1 year, you'll see me there in a locker room somewhere.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you so much for joining us here, Hersey, a real Sonics legend. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us.
No, thank you guys for coming out here for the interview. It's always odd hearing legend. So I'm like, I don't know about that. You know, it was a great time. Now Detlef, you know, he was a legend. And Gary and Sean, you know, I just fit in.
Any starter on one of the best teams in Sonics history certainly deserves that title. So, again, appreciate it, and thanks for listening.